Hello there and welcome to The Last Horror Podcast. My name's Christopher Brown. It seems incredible that Romero has been able to work completely outside the studio system up until this point. Even films like, Creepshow would be the one that sticks in the mind, was all done on very much on Romero's terms. He attempts, though, with his next movie, Monkey Shines, from 1988, to use the studio system to create a film. Though, in a sense, it's still kind of done within his own world. It's filmed with his team to a point. There's a chunky role for Christine, his at the time wife, and Tom Savini does a lot of the work on it. So in a sense, it feels like Romero's attempts to kind of blend his own way of working with the studio system. It doesn't unfortunately work out quite as well as he had hoped.
A man trapped by his own body.
To Alan, to the start of his new life.
So you train monkeys exclusively for quadriplegics? How about if I were to donate a monkey?
She hasn't been exposed to anything weird in the lab.
No.
An animal trained to follow commands.
How am I supposed to take care of it, Jeff?
The idea is that it's going to take care of you.
She's unbelievable. She's like a miniature person.
Get rid of that bird, or so help me.
One with the mind for revenge.
I've been so full of anger. I've had the most horrible thoughts lately.
I made up a formulation based on human memory cells. I've been injecting one of my monkeys.
I don't like this change in you, Alan.
The other with the instinct to kill.
What the hell are you doing to her?
Ella is getting out of the house, and I'm getting out with her.
You do know that that's impossible.
Man is the only animal capable of murder.
Ella, no!
Until now.
She did it for me. Did it because I wanted it done.
Stop it!
From the director of Night of the Living Dead, George A. Romero, the master of terror and suspense.
You're not gonna hurt me. I'm part of you.
Monkey Shines, a new leap into terror.
So let's go to the story first. A guy called Alan, played by Jason Begge, is hit by a truck very early on. He's an athlete, but his problems are quite pronounced after he's hit by this vehicle and becomes a quadriplegic. His relationship with his girlfriend, Linda, becomes incredibly strained. And she actually runs off with the doctor who'd done the work on him, a guy called John Wiseman, who's actually played by Stanley Tucci. Alan becomes increasingly isolated and miserable and depressed, unsurprisingly, with his situation, and attempts to commit suicide. To give him more freedom, a friend of his who's a scientist, played by John Pankow, a character called Jeff. What he does is he works with monkeys, and his work is to do intelligence training with them, and injects them with like some super serum, basically, which was meant to make them more intelligent. Anyway, the monkey he provides for Alan is called Ella, and Ella is at first, as you would imagine, an incredibly useful tool around the house, and but it becomes increasingly apparent that there is more of a bond between Alan and Ella than initially reaches the eye. And not only that Ella is incredibly protective of Alan and is willing to kill and is able to kill, picking up on the emotions and thoughts of Alan to those around him, and acting out his frustrations in periods of extreme violence. So that's our film. Let's just have a think about it in terms of, first of all, of it being a. It's a killer monkey movie. It is a killer monkey movie. There's no way around it. We've got a slasher film where the chimp is the killer. It's just, that's what we've got. Now, how strange as that is, and as weird as the story idea of that is, it does work quite well within the story. And Romero was able to make it relatively believable. Even these scenes of apparent psychic linking between the chimp and our quadriplegic Alan. I think it's fair to say that the experience for Romero was hard. Romero had originally created a very long script, 220 pages. Now that seems excessive for a killer monkey movie, and indeed it is. But thinking about how he had tried to adapt Resident Evil, which we'll get onto it when we talk briefly about his 90s period in the wilderness, it becomes clear that he possibly, more than likely, tried to create a very literal adaptation of the book. When you watch it, I mean, the thought of watching it, we've been down this road before with Season of the Witch, that the thought of watching more of this kind of stuff doesn't fill me particularly with joy. I'm not wildly keen on seeing, you know, another 200-minute cut of Monkey Shines. What I think is, there's a few elements to this. One is that, obviously, the actual people who gave them the money was Orion. And Orion were in financial difficulties and remained in financial difficulties for quite some time. And this film was not the film that was going to save them at all. Even the thought of a George A. Romero R-rated film that, you know, that would have that kudos because it's a Romero movie, was not going to be the one that was going to fire the box office. Obviously, Orion did not know that at the time. There's a classic kind of element of there was meddling going on. Now, what kind of meddling was this? Though the film he delivered seemingly was overlong and had a weird ending, they decided, in their wisdom, to ensure that the film ended on a happy note, not an ambiguous one. And they also reshot a shock ending at the end in a similar vein to Carrie. It doesn't make a lot of sense in terms of what Romero is trying to do, but it does kind of give you the fright at the end of the film, something that would work in terms of, you know, trying to get bums on seats. You know, oh my God, there's this huge shock at the end, really wild shock at the end of the film. You know, that kind of was the thought process. I think it's clear that Romero was, although making a killer monkey movie, a slasher film where the monkey's the killer, was far more interested in elements of a quadriplegic, being isolated on his own, and looking at that kind of that world of what change would be. So, you know, we see at the beginning of the film a very a naked and very, you know, obviously athletic Alan as he's exercising at the start of his day, and then the next time we see him, he's a completely different man, you know, in his wheelchair. And you know, a lot of the film initially is about him kind of settling into that world. I mean, that takes an hour, and one of the biggest shocks, certainly in, you know, that marks the end of the first act, is Alan trying to kill himself, and the reaction of his doctor almost being, oh well, you know, I'm not asked about that, that just happened anyway. The film really comes into its own though in that third act, when it becomes far clearer what's happening and why. the it comes almost Hitchcockian with shots of the camera right in the face of Alan, kind of as he's trying to, you know, maneuver his way around an enemy, which is at his beck and call, and seemingly through jealousy, trying to do what he wants, but obviously, you know, in a misguided way. It's claustrophobic and generally quite tense. You're not sure who could die at that point, and that's kind of where you want it to be. It also works as a trashy 1980s film that, you know, the kind of thing I certainly grew up on, on a Saturday night on a, I don't know, ITV, you know, 9 o'clock movie on ITV, or the violence of, a video rental. You know, a fun, kind of silly, entertaining thriller where, you know, you're not 100% sure how seriously you're meant to be taking it, you know. I'm not 100% sure that's particularly where Romero saw his work. I think he's far more interested, as I said, in this the claustrophobia and the attempts to tell a story about a man who's obviously trapped and the changes to him. It's quite from that point of view, although I would argue it doesn't have like the personalness of, say, Knight Riders. It does have the touch of a writer that is interested. The film that he delivered seemingly was longer, and but the real concerns were around the ending. It tested badly, mainly due to the fact that it wasn't considered to be that scary, and the ending, which is ambiguous at best, was considered to be a bit wrong footing in truth. So Ryan were initially kind of on his back to kind of to kind of get this film down to a manageable length, and indeed the under 2 hours, and it's just a fag paper over 2 hours in the end, certainly in America. With the well, it doesn't really matter, but the length, so it's around the 2 hour mark. So the first thing they insist on, kind of supposedly behind his back, is a jump scare. So what happens is, I mean, it doesn't make any sense. The surgery to fix the problems that Stanley Tucci's character, Dr. Wiseman, has implemented involve begin, and then the monkey leaps out of his back. Obviously, it's a dream sequence. You know, you can be critical of that, but see, De Palma's Carrie has a similar kind of abrupt fuck you kind of jump scare at the end of that film, and everyone thinks that's an absolute classic moment in cinema. So, you know, you can't criticise everything. The other thing is that there was the original ending of the film. There's a subplot in the movie which goes nowhere between Jeff and his boss, Harold Burbage, who's the dean, and they have repeated arguments all the way through the film about whether or not any of this research is actually going to go anywhere. Now, it's used in the film to kind of explain why Jeff would continue to inject this monkey with this super serum, which obviously is the thing that creates the psychic bond between man and ape. But in the end, the original alternative ending, the dean, it becomes clear that has been injecting all the monkeys with this super serum, and the monkeys have actually kind of taken over Burbage's mind. And that's kind of the end of the film, which is weird, I think it's fair to say. I think Duell as well, the book, is fair to say, he's a bit of a potboiler. And I think that kind of is seen in some of the stranger elements of the film. The response to the movie wasn't massively positive. It was mixed at best. Mainly, because it was considered, you know, a silly, tight thriller that goes on for 2 hours seems preposterous. And indeed, Romero's idea of, you know, going big and cutting back was not successful, I think, certainly. Mainly because the time it gets going, this last 45 minutes of the film, you're kind of already a bit fed up with it. It takes a long time to get where it wants to get to, which is, you know, in all honesty, quite a trashy story, you know. So I think those kind of criticisms, shall we say. And the film was, drumroll, not a success at the box office. Oh, George. It cost $7 million to make. It grossed 5.3 in the US. And unlike some of his other films, didn't really get the cult appeal back that it didn't, you know, find its audience later on, I would argue, although it's because it's a studio movie, it probably certainly found its way around to being a probably made its money back in the end for Ryan, but it certainly wasn't the breakout hit that they were so hopeful for. What's more interesting about the film is the actual like effect work in it. So one of the key parts of this is that I think people think that there's a lot of monkey, you know, proper monkey effects, and the monkeys are real. Well, obviously they're not. I think it's really interesting that you see Savini, you know, in 1988 saying, I want to move away from gore and be seen as a gore person and being seen more of a general artist and an effects artist. And, you know, by the time we get to this point, you know, people don't realise exactly how much of an impact, you know, his work was doing. Obviously a lot of the special effects go to Stephen Kirchhoff. But a lot of the makeup effects are Savini. I think, if I'm being honest, looking at this film, I mean, certainly it's not my favourite Romero, but as I say, the it kind of does pick up near the end in terms of being, you know, fun. And I think it is a fun film, regardless of Romero's, you know, intrigue in trying to tell a very different story. Romero felt quite burnt by it, the experience. He wasn't used to losing quite so much control over his artwork. And although this is obviously, I mean, geez, compare it even to Day of the Dead in terms of, you know, how it's been shot. And it's a completely different kind of film, you know. It's the work of James A. Contner, who, you know, really is better known for TV work, like things like Buffy and Miami Vice and Star Trek and stuff. You know, it's like night and day in terms of, you know, that gloss and shine. And indeed, moving forward, we see Romero's how his work looked massively jump. Even, you know, with when he goes to his next film, The Two Evil Eyes, you know, they look a lot glossier and a lot shinier. This is a very different world that Romero is creating. And I do think, interesting, the Hitchcockian elements that Romero is trying to do. He is definitely still, you know, a horror director, but is looking to do more than that. And certainly, Romero, this is a point now where Romero has no interest in making, you know, a zombie film. And he wants to do something different. Now, that's something different in this case. Maybe doesn't work as positively as you would like, but it still has an element for him that works well. And finally, as well, I think, you know, when you turn there and you think, well, what is Romero trying to do? There are elements of incredible bravery in the film. I mean, there is a sex scene between a woman, an able-bodied woman, and a quadriplegic man, and you just don't see stuff like that. It's not seen, and you know, it doesn't even try to be anything that it's not. This sex scene between Alan and Melanie, who's played by Kate McNeil, is just a touching moment within the movie. It's not salacious. But at the same time, it's still obviously, you know, it doesn't pretend that it's not something it's not. And that element of bravery, of unusualness, of even in this film, which, you know, for better or worse, does not, you know, fire people up on all cylinders. I'm sure there are people who will stand next to Monkey Shines and declare it the greatest of Romero's canon, and, you know, you're wrong. And certainly, it definitely has its fans. And for me, it's quite clear why. The last half hour was fantastic. You know, it was really quite gripping and exciting and intense. But also because it is willing to go to places that you just don't normally see in mainstream films. So for me, on that front, you know, once again, Romero, just by being him and just going, this is interesting, and being kind of a cool, kind of, you know, insightful, thoughtful guy, is able to create, you know, do something that just off the wall, different to what anyone else is doing. And for me, that's, you know, that is exactly why I'm doing this podcast series for all these weeks, because, you know, even with this, you're like going, isn't that fascinating, that sex scene? Isn't, you know, in this film that, you know, regardless of, it is well made, I mean, it is a well made film, you know, regardless of that, is still able to do something completely off the wall. And, you know, it might be a bit of a Frankenstein's monster in terms of studio interference, but fuck me. Even then, Romero was able to do something that you just don't see elsewhere.
I just want to get you to produce.
You can't do it, can you? You can't fire me, because you know that if anybody around here is going to strike gold, it's going to be me. Yeah. You'll live.
Anyway, thanks very much for listening. Hope you enjoyed that. Next week, I think the story kind of goes that Romero kind of shuffles off away from the studio system for a bit, which is kind of true. But what he really does is he works with a friend of his, with Two Evil Eyes, which is both him and Dario Argento co-collaborate, and they both have their own short, and it's kind of welded together as a thing. For better or worse, I would argue that, you know, Argento is probably a little bit away from his best at this stage, and Romero is a fair chunk away from the Romero that possibly people love the most, shall we say. But it's still an interesting film, and I'm with having a chat through. And then obviously, you know, we are heading towards his fallow period in the 90s, shall we say. Anyway, if you want to get a hold of me, please do. My email address is christopher@thelasthorrorpodcast.com. You can get me on Twitter at @orange_monkey, or you can go to the website, thelasthorrorpodcast.com. Huge thanks to Rob, who donated via the Buy Me a Coffee page on the website. So you go there, you can kind of support the show. The money that goes in, it just pays for the hosting costs, in fairness. But What is interesting is Rob asked if the plan is still to go back and do the Section 3 films. That is the plan. We're going to finish this off, and then I'm going to take a couple of weeks to prepare, and then we're going to basically launch straight into what will effectively be the Visio Nasties podcast season 2, which will be a 2-year project at least probably take me a little bit longer than that. We'll get onto that. I'll do a proper podcast that kind of explains the plan and where I am and what that's going to be. But for the people that are listening to the Visio Nasties podcast at the moment, and because since it's when it's gone on Spotify, there are a fair chunk of people. Yay. It will almost be like as if there was just a standard continuation, as if I didn't stop doing it, even though it's been like 4 years or something between the two, which is weird, but there you go. Anyway, that's for the future. We've still got a chunk of Romero to get through. That's awful, isn't it? I'm really looking forward to kind of getting into the meat of his kind of comeback in the noughties. And I will give as a passionate defence of Bruiser as I can anyway. But we'll get to that in the as soon. We're not far off, not massively far off that. Anyway, I'm rambling again, as I tend to do at the moment at the end of these ones. Take care, and I will speak to you soon. Goodbye.